Right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Me, Myself and Hopefully You podcast. I'm your host, Tariq, a 19-year-old university student currently experiencing a midlife crisis as he has no idea what he wants to do with his life. So rather than see a career advisor or a therapist, I decided to start a podcast where I invite guests from an array of backgrounds to tell me their story. And whilst finding out about them, hopefully I can find out more about myself too. So if you can relate, or maybe you just want to see where I end up, join me every Sunday right here. Ladies and gentlemen, now I know I always say this, but what an episode I have for you today. This week, I sit with a former Metropolitan officer, undercover cop, and fugitive hunter. He tells me more about how his troublesome youth led him to swapping the backseat of the police car to the driver's seat. He also argues passionately as to why we need to not only decriminalize the use of drugs, but legalize it entirely. Finally, he goes on to describe his new life's purpose, finding fugitive Kevin Paul, who is wanted in connection with two murders. Please join me in welcoming Peter Blexley.
So, Peter, I just want to start off with asking a quick fire question, some quick fire questions, just to get to know you a bit more. The first question that I want to ask you is, what's the last thing that's on your camera roll?
Last thing on my camera? Okay. Yeah. I'm going to delve into my mobile here and have a look. Partly terrified because it could be hugely embarrassing. The last thing is... No, it's not, fortunately. No, I don't indulge in such behaviour.
I don't know, Peter. We'll find out more.
Yeah, that's true. You're going to trick it out of me, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I took a photograph yesterday of a book that arrived that I am now reading called The Devil by Graham Johnson. Now, this book was published in 2007, and it essentially is the life story of a man called Stephen French. Stephen with a PH, French, who was a notorious criminal in Liverpool. And the reason I'm reading it is it's background research for my ongoing hunt for Kevin Paul, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit later on. So yeah. I took that photograph of the book yesterday and posted it onto social media saying, you know, this has just arrived. This is background reading for my hunt for Paul. And that is the last one in my role.
Right, okay. You got a book. Okay, we'll definitely get into Kevin Paul as soon as possible. My second quick fire question is, who would you say is your, if you had to pick one role model in life, who would you say it is?
Can they be alive or dead?
Yeah. Anyone.
Muhammad Ali.
Okay. I wasn't expecting that. Why Muhammad Ali?
Well, he was just the greatest heavyweight boxer that ever graced the planet. His movement, his fleet of foot, his speed of hand, and his ability as a boxer was absolutely wonderful. Of course, sadly, he had the best years of his career taken away from him because, as he famously said, I ain't got no fight with no Viet Cong. So he refused to be drafted and was stripped of his titles. And so we didn't see him in his absolute prime, although he was absolutely magnificent. Now, as an aside, he is indisputably, in my opinion, one of the most handsome men that's ever walked the planet. So, of course, I'm deeply, deeply envious because to have had the looks of that fella would have been astonishing. And he was a man of great principle, really great principle. And he stood by that and he was willing to suffer personally, enormously, at great cost, because he had a principle that he stuck by. And that, of course, is a wonderful characteristic in any human being. He was also incredibly witty and funny and charming. And I just think he's been one of the greatest human beings that ever walks this planet.
It's interesting the way you describe Muhammad Ali, because the way you describe him, I'd actually say you're actually a lot similar to Muhammad Ali than you think. In terms of the first point that you made is that you said He was he was extremely good looking. But when I was doing the research for this episode, I thought, let me see if I can find a young Peter Blexley. And I did find a few. And I thought he was a pretty good looking guy, especially during the 70s, I think the pictures were from. I thought, well, you're downplaying yourself there too much there, Peter.
Never, ever, ever in the Muhammad Ali League, let me tell you. And as I just reached to my windowsill in my little office here, no, before you go any further, right? If we talk about boxing, this is the biggest boxing trophy I ever won, right? It's dated 1982. I was a decidedly average boxer. And I'll tell you how average I was. My nickname was Horiz, which was short for horizontal, right? So that gives you a kind of idea as to my level of talent.
Oh, no, I'd say if there was you and Muhammad Ali, both in your prime, I'd say you'd be able to, in terms of looks, maybe not in the boxing levels, in terms of looks, I reckon you could compete, Peter. You're doing yourself over there, Peter.
No, I would be firmly in his shadow when it came to looks. And if ever we'd have got in the ring together, I tell you this for definite, I would not have been able to lay a glove on him.
I don't think anyone could. You've got that. If people haven't seen that famous video where he dodges a load of. Like, I'm not the biggest boxing fan in the world, but I know the basics. That famous clip where he's dodging loads left, right, and centre in the corner. It's unbelievable. And I think the point that you made there, where people didn't actually get to see him in his prime because of the fact that he refused to get drafted. Is even more sort of credit to him, because he was so good outside of his prime.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know what I think is the saddest thing? I mean, it was very sad that he was struck down with Parkinson's, and so his latter years, so many of his wonderful abilities were cruelly taken away from him. But if we'd had a fit and articulate Muhammad Ali in his later years, I think he would have been a great unifying force when it came to Islam, because, of course, he converted to Islam, was a devout Muslim. And I think he would have been a great, great ambassador for that faith. And I think he would have been a conciliator, a peacemaker. And I think that he would have been just an all-round power for good.
Well, I mean, even with Parkinson's and the way his life, tragically ended up being, he still is regarded, at least in the Muslim community, as a Muslim myself, he is still regarded as, someone that they managed to do it. And, the name Muhammad is so important to us, because Muhammad, peace be upon him, is seen as our final messenger. He's our role model. That's how we want our life to be. And for him to have the name Muhammad, and for him, I don't know if you know about the star, his star in LA or something like that. So he refused to have a star on the floor. He said, if I'm having a star, I want it to be on a wall, because the name Muhammad shouldn't be on the floor. And things like that. He was so proud of his religion, and he always talked about God. So even with, the way his life turned out to be, he still was such a great figurehead for Muslims. And I remember when he died, I remember thinking, I want not just Muslims to think about that of me, but I also want non-Muslims to think he was a great guy and he believed in God and he had faith. Not that faith is the be all and end all, but I want to be a good sort of proponent for my religion, for my cultural beliefs, for my family, etc., etc. And he's definitely a role model for me in that aspect as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a man of faith. I understand how important faith is to people. I was brought up to sing in a choir three times on a Sunday in a Anglican, Church of England church, and so faith was kind of drummed into me from a very, very early age. And I was confirmed, which meant you served as an altar boy and all of that. So church featured large in my life until really I went in the police, and then I lost all belief in faith. But I think I've lived a good life in the main. Yeah, there have been moments of things that were appalling and I'm not in any way remotely proud of, but I get faith. I really get it. And I understand how important it is to people. And I get a real buzz whenever I go visiting a new city or a village or a town. I'm fascinated by religious architecture. I mean, if you look at some of the greatest buildings in our nation alone, you know, there's a mosque up in Northwest London. By crikey, if you haven't seen it, you just have to see this. You know, there's a great Gurdwara near us in Gravesend, you know, which is like just an astonishing piece of architecture. And then you've got Westminster Cathedral and Canterbury Cathedral. And when I go in those places, even though I have no faith, I can appreciate how important they are to people, the magnificence of them, and I'm glad they're on our landscape.
100%. They're amazing pieces of art and architecture, sorry, and history and so much more. My final question, or final, sorry, quickfire question is, if there was, God forbid, a house fire in your house, and everyone survived, but you could only keep one thing, you could only protect one thing, what would that one thing be?
So my family have all got out safely.
Yeah.
Thank goodness
and
for that.
As well. And you've got your phone, because you always have your phone and your laptop as well.
Phone and laptop. I don't know. You know,
their first answer. Everyone says phone and laptop. I'm like, no, everyone says that. I'm bored of that one. I want another answer.
Right. Yeah. I'm not a particularly materialistic sort of bloke. You know, I'm very lucky that we live in a nice house. And there's a decent, inexpensive car on the drive. And, you know, we're not, the wolf is a long, long way from our door. But as you'll see from my cheap and cheerful sort of T-shirt and stuff, although I've got some nice shirts, you know, so forgive me for not dressing up for your pod, Tariq. Don't take it as a sign of disrespect. I'm just, what possession would I take? That's a really tough question to ask. As you can see, I'm struggling to think about it. Can you leave that with me? And if something comes to me in the next hour or so, then maybe I'll get back to it.
I will. Yeah. All right. If something comes up, then feel free to bring it up. Or we'll ask that as one of the final questions. So
I've got it.
Oh, you've got it. All right. What is it then, Peter?
If it was a fire and it was the middle of the night, for example, it would have to be my dressing gown, because I wouldn't want to subject the neighbours to what was underneath it.
All right. Yeah, fair enough. I mean, to be fair, I thought you'd say one of your fancy suits, because I've seen all those fancy little snazzy shirts that you always have on. I'm always jealous of them. They're always like patterned or something like that.
I've got about seven of them, and I rotate them, you know. Don't think that I've got wardrobes full of them. But I like a shirt with that's flamboyant and has some character, I will admit.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, 100%. I'm the same as well. I don't think I'm as flamboyant as you are. You're definitely a lot more brave than I am. But I've seen some of the shirts and the suits and your Instagram with the dancing. I've seen all that on the Twitter as well. Brilliant. We'll definitely have a discussion about that. And when I'm promoting the podcast, I will definitely be using some of those clips. Just before we sort of get into, I guess, the interview phase of it all, if you could give a short introduction about Peter Blexley, what would it be?
Yeah, well, I suspect your audience is a youthful one. So straight away, young people, as if you hadn't already noticed, I'm old. Okay, well, I'm 61. I mean, I know 61. Yeah, I'm younger than I look, right? I get that. You know, I've had a fairly hard life in some regards, so I'm younger than I look. But I feel much younger than I am. You know, I feel much more youthful than my years. I've got an energy and an enthusiasm and a zest for life and work that I had when I was half my age. So I was a bit of an errant youth, shall we say, largely the product of a one parent family. My alcoholic dad cleared off when I was about 10 or 11 years old. And quite frankly, it was good riddance to bad rubbish at the time. That left me, my older sister and my mum in a house that my mum couldn't afford. And so after a couple of years of, you know, legal wranglings and procedures and all of that, and mum getting divorced, we had to sell the house. We bought a flat in Bexley Heath, which is a London borough, the outermost southeast London borough. it is by no means the tough side of the street. I get that, you know, I accept that. It's a bit of a leafy suburb, really, to be honest with you. And my mum worked very hard every day to put food on the table and clothes on our backs. My elder sister went off to pursue her nursing training when she was 16. So there I was, 12, 13 years old, mum disappearing off to work, didn't really enjoy school very much. So I truanted, foolishly, stupidly truanted. And it is a matter of regret that I didn't make more of my education, because life in later years, I think, would have been easier and more opportunities may have been available to me. So I got involved in petty crime, shoplifting, criminal damage, graffiti, those kind of things. Spent far too much time in the bookmakers. I used to go to school, sign in the register, bunk off after a couple of lessons, go home, get changed. And believe it or not, they let me in the bookies and they let me bet. Now, you know, I couldn't have looked 18. Could I have looked 18.
How old were you?
15, 14, 15, 16.
Right. And they just let you in?
And they let me in. And I placed my bets. And in those days, there used to be three races on ITV in the afternoon, imaginatively called the ITV3. I used to either stay in the bookies and watch them, or if another mate of mine had bunked off school, we'd go to his house or my flat and we'd watch the races in the afternoon on the telly, instead of having or being in a classroom and my head in a book. Foolish, foolish young man. But so left school at 16. School were very glad to see the back of me. In fact, so much so that on the last day, right, we bunked over the pub, right? And in that, you know, I'm 16, right? So three pints and I'm like, you know, I'm well on the way.
I mean, I don't know. I've never drank, but okay.
Well, of course you haven't. So please forgive me. But anyway.
No, it's fine.
So were you to be 16 and were you to drink three pints of beer, if you weren't habitually used to it, it would have a significant effect on you. Trust me.
Right, okay.
So, and of course, in the playground, there's flower bombs. We're causing havoc. Everybody's ripping each other's shirts, writing on them, all that kind of stuff. Flour in the hair, ink all over us. Like, I'm punk a state. Era, yeah? Sorry?
Was this the punk rock sort of era?
No, this is just misbehavior at school. Another year or two later. This is just misbehavior on the last day of school when I'm 16 and I know I'm never going back. Right, so I'm half drunk, I look an absolute state, and I get dragged in front of the assistant headmaster, who detested me with a passion, and his name was Mr. Mason, and he called me over, and I sort of, you know, part staggered, part swaggered over to him, and he went, Blexley, he said, you came here with nothing, he said, you leave here with next to nothing. He said, you are a nothing and you will become nothing. Now get out of my school. And so I did. Summer of 1976, wonderful summer, astonishing weather, still unmatched in my lifetime, the weather of that year, you know, really amazing. I went fishing, came home every 3 or 4 days to collect some more food and have a bath. And eventually it got to sort of September. And my mum said, you know, have you got any plans for the rest of your life? And I thought, I hadn't really considered that. Anyway, went and got a job. In those days, you could get a job fairly easily. And I got a job in a store called Woolworths, which was a very famous chain of stores back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, it was on every high street. And I got a job as an assistant warehouseman. And I loved it. Lugging heavy boxes around, having a laugh and a joke with my boss in the warehouse, carrying 40-pound lumps of cheese down to the ladies on the delicatessen who adored me because I'd do anything for them and we'd have a laugh and a joke and all of that. And
you were
great
good-looking
time.
As well.
Say again?
Because you were good-looking as well, Peter.
Well, you know, I've got some photographs that utterly disprove that mad theory of yours. But anyway... And had a great time. And of course, I'm earning money. And there was overtime to be had. I couldn't believe the amount of money I was earning. you know, bearing in mind, we come from a pretty, like, you know, skint background.
Yeah.
And again, that was all jollying along quite nicely after a couple of months, but it didn't match my mum's ambitions for me. You know, she was very proud that my sister had gone off to nursing, and my sister still is in nursing. We're all very proud of that as a family. Like, we're all proud of all our NHS staff, particularly in recent times. And I came home one night, bearing in mind that I am occasionally still involved in this petty crime nonsense. And to my absolute horror, sitting in the lounge of our flat is this enormous, great police officer in full uniform. And of course, the first thing I thought was, oh, crikey, what am I going to get arrested for? But it turned out that my mum had arranged for this cop to be in our lounge to sell the idea to me of joining the police. You know, it was one of those old neighbourhood bobbies, which are much missed in many, many places, particularly around here where you never see a copper ever these days.
Yeah.
We used to have a friendly local PCSO who was always coming in my house for, you know, for a cup of tea and a biscuit. And I don't see sight or sound of any of those either these days. Anyway, back to this cop in the lounge. He really sold the idea to me of joining the police. You know, the variety of things that you could do. If you like dogs, you could be a dog handler. If you want to ride a horse, you could go in the mounted branch. If you like investigating crime, you can become a detective. You know, and so much more. And of course, now the police is more diverse with more different roles than it has ever been. There's literally hundreds of different roles you can do in the cops these days. Job security, regular wage, a pension to look forward to after you've done 30 years. He really sold the idea to me. And before he left, he pulled out the application form and I filled it in. And a few short weeks later, with a haircut that I thought was short enough, but I pretty soon found out wasn't, I walked through the gates of the Metropolitan Police Cadet Corps training school at Hendon. And suddenly my life was transformed.
What was it, right? So, I mean, that's a big sort of background there. And even sort of, I have it written down about how you had this police officer come into your house. And, you know, you were obviously shocked initially, but he gave you the application, and by the time he'd left, you'd already started signing it and you wanted to join the police cadets. What is it specifically that enticed you to join?
All the things that he spoke to me about, you know, the job security, the regular wage, the, you know, and of course, the diversity of roles and the excitement of the chase and cops and robbers, good guys and bad guys, you know, all of that, which was really, really appealing to me. And he did such a great job, but he really got me as well, as bit of an errant kid, you know, at 16. He really got me. He didn't talk down to me. He wasn't condescending in any way, shape or form. He was just a really lovely bloke. And I think probably subconsciously, I thought, well, if these are the kind of people I'm going to be working with, you bet I'll fill that form out.
Do you think that sort of, and I'm kind of going off script here, but do you think that's the sort of, that's what's missing, especially when it comes to relations between police and ordinary people, especially younger people? There's that sort of, the police speak down almost to the younger people because they're trying to impose something, and then the younger people start having a bit of attitude. You know how you were saying how you spoke to that assistant head teacher, you know, you had a bit of attitude to them, now you have it to the police, and then it just doesn't create a friendly environment that you really should have with the people that are looking after you and looking after your community.
The relationship between the public and the police is a complex one. And we could be here for days discussing it, to be perfectly frank. I think there are certain problems with contemporary policing that make their relationship with the public so strained. The coronavirus has had a hugely negative impact because the police have had to police a pandemic, and there is not one cop in the land that signed up to do that. Okay. Yeah. Nobody anticipated it. Nobody signed up to do that. And believe it or not, the police do not like curtailing people's freedoms. Your rank and file, that cop who is at the front there. Unless, of course, you're breaking the law. And then they love to curtail your freedoms by slapping the handcuffs on and dragging you down the neck. And that's only right. They want to be able to facilitate protest. Cops love it. When they're on a Saturday afternoon and they are, you know, flanking the protesters and they're just walking at a nice, leisurely, ambling kind of pace with the protesters to wherever they want to gather and have their rally and make their speeches and get their airtime and column inches, the police are into all that. You know, they like that. Yeah. They understand as much as we do. The police have got a history of demonstrating as well. You know, the police have marched on Parliament and over pay and conditions and all those kind of things. Yeah, so you know, they have a history of protesting. There was a police strike many, many decades ago. They have a federation, right? Not a union, a federation. But, you know, so the police do get it and they like to facilitate protests. But in this pandemic, there's been hurriedly cobbled together laws out of necessity, but the police have had to sort of impose those laws without there being any precedent for them to rely on. No judicial precedent, no policing procedure precedent for them to have learned from and to have refined their practices. So they've been flying by the seat of their pants a lot of the time. And some of the directives that have been handed down by the College of Policing, again, have been rushed and perhaps not very well thought out. And it's those men and women on the front line that have copped it in the ear hole and a lot worse. So they have my sympathy. There is an element in policing sometimes of lions being led by donkeys. And it's very unfortunate. And that whole relationship is a bit strained amongst some. Of course, the overwhelming and silent majority of the public like the police.
Yeah.
They're very grateful that they're there. They're very thankful that they're out there 24 hours a day so we can sleep soundly in our beds. But of course, we've got rising crime. We've had decreasing police numbers. And the decade of austerity has had a dreadful impact upon policing. Absolutely dreadful. This Tory government has butchered policing budgets. I know Johnson now talks about 20,000 extra police. Yeah. You need double that. It's utter nonsense. They are hemorrhaging officers on a daily basis because they've just had enough. And that's a shame. It's a real shame. Pay, conditions, pensions, all of that butchered during austerity together with the numbers. And that has had a significant impact together with the pandemic of getting us to the position that we're in now.
So, I mean, from that, I think, I know you said that the vast silent majority of the public are quite happy with the police and support the police and appreciate the fact that the police is always there. But there is a growing movement of defund the police and I'm sure people have heard of kill the bill movements, etc. And, you know, you have been quoted as saying, you know, I think I listened to a radio interview where you said something like the police are damned if they do and damned if they don't. Now, you know, with these movements, what's your response to people who do say defund the police and kill the bill movement and kill the bill? Because their argument is that, you know, according to The Guardian, for example, 1.5% of rape cases go ignored. You yourself admitted on the Brian Rose podcast that people don't want to report crimes because they believe that the police aren't going to do anything, that they don't do anything sometimes. If the police aren't going to do anything, then why don't we just defund the police?
Yeah, well, policing is in crisis. I go back to that, what I was saying, you know, just a few moments ago about the lack of police numbers and the lack of police funding. Because don't think for one moment, whilst I am a supporter of police when they get things right, and I'm very swift to say that, I'm also one of the most strident and vocal, high-profile critics of them when they get it wrong. Now, okay, let's deal with this kill the bill movement and these recent protests about a bill that is going through Parliament at the moment, right? The police didn't draw that bill up. The police are not going to get it onto the statute book. The politicians are doing that, okay? The politicians that so many people voted for that the Tories ended up with a majority of over 80 blooming MPs, right? So when people have got a gripe over this piece of legislation, it ain't the police's fault. It's the legislators. Get it? So if you've got a gripe, lobby your MPs. Write to your MPs. March on Parliament. Well, actually, don't, because we're still in the grip of a pandemic and such gatherings remain illegal. But that is where your ire, your anger, your frustration should be directed at. Not the men and women in blue who will always come to your aid at the worst moment in your life. You can guarantee it almost exclusively, that in the worst moment of your life, the police arrive to try and sort things out or make things a bit better. So if we look at Bristol, when some numbskull tried to set fire to a police van while a police officer was sitting inside it, what has that got to do with being fed up about a piece of legislation? How is that going to further their cause? How is that going to stop the bill going through Parliament? Or how is that going to make the bill be amended so that the bits of it that people are not happy with, and I suspect they've never blooming read it, right, are going to get changed? Direct your anger where it should be directed at, and that is the politicians, not the men and women on the front line of policing, who quite frankly, whilst they don't always get it right, because they have millions of interactions with people every week, literally millions, right? So they are going to get it wrong sometimes. But generally speaking, they're decent people who joined to make a difference, to make things better.
I don't know if you've actually seen it, but anyone that does sort of believe in the defund the police movement, I'd highly recommend you check out what happened in a place, they named it Chaz in Seattle. I don't know if you've heard of it. And what they did was, it was following the George Floyd death, and which is obviously an entirely different sort of conversation. But following that, there was a huge defund the police movement. And what they did in this area in Seattle, they essentially got rid of the police. They didn't allow police to come in. They said, right, we're going to get rid of the police and we're going to do this on our own. Within a few days, sexual assault cases were going up. There were murders on the streets. Everyone had guns. There were robberies left, right and center. And it was absolute chaos. And after a few weeks, the mayor of Seattle had to call in. The military had to come in and basically get rid of the people that were the new leaders of Chaz. I'd highly recommend you check out, go on the internet, type in Chaz Seattle, what's going on or whatever, and you'll find the story. Because that is an example of what can happen if you do not have police and you don't have, you know, correct funding. And I think people often forget that the police lost 20,000 officers under austerity. You know, I think more than 20,000 officers. And then on top of that, now they're having to deal with sort of the fact that there's no youth clubs around, there's no youth support around. The police now have to deal with that. And like you said, it's, you know, the police have had their own sort of battles with government as well. In terms of the Prime Minister at the time, Theresa May, you've quoted her before saying that she came out and said that the police were crying wolf and that's why the cuts are happening and it's the police's fault. And she was the Home Secretary. And I want to ask you that about that as well, actually. She was the Home Secretary at one point. She was this Home Secretary between 2010 and 2015. She was essentially, you know, you can say she was the leader of the police force because, you know, she's at the top and everyone, you know, reports to her. And yet she's coming out in 2017 saying, no, the police are at fault. How did that sort of feel for you as an ex-police officer? And how do you think the police force at the time felt?
I've said it publicly. Theresa May was a dangerous and deluded woman. She had no idea about modern contemporary policing. No idea whatsoever. You know, and on her watch, well, on her government's watch, both when she was Home Secretary and then Prime Minister, the age of austerity, you know, completely, not only did they lose 20,000 odd police officers, but there were tens of thousands of support staff jobs that were cut as well. And you can't do that and not expect there to be any difference. Whoever was in her ear advising her, or even if she was forming her own opinions and policies herself, whatever the situation, they were fools. They were idiots. And the tide of teenage bloodshed that tragically flows through our streets today should lead to her feet in many, many respects. All right. Crime and policing are complex issues. There's no quick fixes. And now we've got a lunatic Home Secretary who just says tough. Yeah. The only words we're going to get tough on this. We're going to get tough on that. We're going to get tough on the other. It ain't a case about getting tough. It's about getting clever and smart and innovating and understanding and funding properly. It's so complex. You know, why do we have rising crime figures, violent crime, knife crime, gang crime, teenagers committing crime? It's very, very complex. And I'll just rattle through some of the, you know, reasons that might be factors, if I may. And some of these are uncomfortable truths. Poverty, of course, social deprivation, a lack of opportunity, racism, quite possibly. Absent parents, yes, quite possibly. And many other factors, right? These are complex, complex things. A lack of facilities and opportunities for young people, not only in education, but employment and youth facilities, sports facilities and all of that. Look at the vast number of clubs that have been shut. Now, I'm not saying a youth club is the answer to all of society's ills, because it isn't.
Yeah.
But it might just help one or two kids. And if it does then it's worth
one or two kids off the streets, doesn't it? And that's one or two potential murders. Like, ultimately, it's worth it. Yeah. If it's one or two less deaths, one or two less parents, you know, having to grieve or bury their own child.
Very, very complex matters. But you know what the number one issue is, and which is the reason that there is so much crime and bloodshed, loss of life. Tragically, it is the war that cannot and will not ever be won, which is the war on drugs.
Exactly.
Our prohibitionist drug policy is an utter, utter nonsense. We've been fighting this war on drugs for 50 years and nothing's changed. Well, in fact, things have got worse by this prohibitionist policy. And, you know, I'm quite an authority on this because most of my career was dedicated to the war on drugs. At one stage in my life, I was far too familiar with drugs than I ever should have been. Fool, yet again. You know, so I know a bit about drugs, and I know that this war on drugs must simply stop. And the way forward is global legalization and regulation of the entire industry. Stop making it illicit, legalize it, regulate it, tax it, control it. And I can hear people saying, oh, what? So you're going to make Big Pharma even more money? Yeah. I'd rather Big Pharma have money than organized crime. Their vice-like grip on this industry causes untold misery. And it could all be so very, very different.
But if Big Pharma make money, at least you can tax. This is the thing. I think people often forget that, okay, yeah, you legalize it, but then you can also regulate it. And that's something that we can't do if it's on the street, in the back alley, behind a pub, around a corner, et cetera, et cetera. It's just not possible to do. And the first, a few years ago, and you know, I'm 19, so when I was like 15, I think, when I first heard the idea of legalizing all drugs, I thought, that's stupid. Why would you legalize all drugs? Then everyone's just going to start, you know, doing everything left, right, and center, injecting themselves and having a great time, etc. But then I came across, and you said is someone that you really like, is Neil Woods, and he was on the True Geordie podcast, and he basically, the first time I sort of heard of the idea of the war on drugs is never going to be won. We need to legalize and regulate all drugs. Why do you think that after so many people who have been on the front line, like yourself, like Neil Woods, they're saying that we should legalize it, it's the best way to do it, yet the politicians don't seem to be listening? Why do you think, or the country doesn't seem to be listening? Why do you think that's the case?
Thank you for listening to Woodsy. And Neil Woods is one of my heroes. As far as I'm concerned, from former law enforcement people, he is the granddaddy of drug law reform. I would urge people to buy his books and read them, to listen to him on whatever platform you can find him speaking, to follow UK Leap on social media. That's Law Enforcement Action Partnership. He's a man of great wisdom, tremendous knowledge, and he puts forward the most coherent arguments ever. He makes my thinking on the subject of drug law reform look like it was hurriedly scribbled on the back of a fag packet, right? He's the granddaddy. Check him out. Right. Wyatt is, well, let me first say on a positive, because I am a sickeningly optimistic kind of bloke. The drug law reform movement has unstoppable momentum. I absolutely guarantee that in your lifetime, there will be radical drug law reform. You will live to see the industry legalized and regulated. I would like to think I would, but I'm 61, you know, and I'm a foolish smoker and I like a glass of red wine and all of that kind of stuff. So I don't know how much longer I've got.
Maybe the economic impact of the pandemic might lead to it. I don't know. I know this is very idealistic, but the economic impacts of, of the pandemic, and then maybe someone might go, well, look at this money that we can make if we regulate it, if we legalize it, potentially. I don't know. But sorry to interrupt.
Oh, absolutely. It will need global intergovernmental agreements. But you see, the reason why it hasn't happened yet is because so much about politics is about fear. Frighten people, and they'll do what we say. Look at some of our mainstream media. The Daily Mail, for example. Excuse me. Right? What does that do? Frightens the life out of people, doesn't it? Right? That's what it's there for. Banner screaming headlines. Not that I read them, but I see them pop up on paper reviews on the telly. You know, terrify everybody. We're all going to die. Well, on that note, they're right, because we are all going to die, right? But not how the Daily Mail would have us frightened into thinking we will die. So if you take a fictional character who I call Mrs. Miggins, okay? Mrs. Miggins lives in the Cotswolds in a very nice cottage. And you know what? She's absolutely lovely, right? You know, she's a grandma. She loves her family. A very nice lady, and she bakes.
Not like a Karen, is she?
No.
Oh, okay. She's not like a Karen. That's all right.
No. Mrs. Miggins is a delight. Mrs. Miggins is an absolute joy, and she bakes the most wonderful Victoria sponge. Okay, right. So, but she lives in the Cotswolds. She's never had any dealing whatsoever with a drug. All her grandchildren have. Right, yeah. But she doesn't know about that.
She doesn't know about that.
All her grandchildren that have gone to uni have all tried this, that, and the other, and blah, 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 and they're all familiar with a bit of gear. Right? But Mrs. Miggins doesn't know that. Actually, some of her own children, you know, who are in their 50s and 60s, have had a dabble. But Mrs. Miggins thinks, no, they haven't, because she reads the Daily Mail every day, and the Daily Mail tells her that drugs are bad, that they're going to kill you. And it's terrifying, right? Okay. And Mrs. Miggins believes that. She does vote Tory. Okay. All right. But, you know, I believe in sort of conversation and conciliation and debate and discussion rather than locking heads. So I can sit down.
She just votes Tory. That's the side thing. But the other stuff is the more important.
Yeah. And some things, when she says things, I just let them go.
Yeah.
You know, let them go. Because I am just contemplating having another slice of her Victoria sponge. Actually,
you don't want to offend her, right? Or else that's no Victoria sponge for you, Peter.
It's so good. And she really is lovely. You know, none of us are perfect, right? So, because she's voted Tory all her life, you know, and she's very proud of the fact that Jeremy Clarkson and David Cameron, you know, lived in the neighbouring village and all that kind of stuff, right? Okay, she's very proud of those sort of things.
I love how much you mean. I love how you've gone from just a Miss Miggins character to now she's got this and she's got that. You could write an entire book on just Miss Miggins.
Mrs. Miggins, yeah. So because she is that kind of voter that always votes Tory and always will, believes that drugs are bad, reads the Daily Mail, loves David Cameron because he lives in the neighbouring village and occasionally he pops into the butcher's, you know, and the butcher tells us he's been in, right? Okay. You can't get through to Mrs. Miggins about drugs, right? But I would love to. I would love to be sitting in her lounge having a cordial chat over a cuppa and slice of cake. And what would really shock her is when I pick my phone up and say, do you know what, Mrs. Miggins? I bet within half hour I could get any drug I want delivered to your front door, courtesy of County Lines. And I bet I could. I absolutely guarantee I could. You know, not because I source drugs. I don't condone drug taking in any way, shape or form. Been there, done that, acted the like a rear end, and I wouldn't condone or encourage any form of drug taking. I really wouldn't. I haven't touched a drug for 17 years, and they've been the best 17 years of my life. No coincidence there, ladies and gentlemen. But anyway, right? So Mrs. Miggins, and there's millions of her, right, are just terrified about drugs. They're not educated about drugs. They don't realise that every night of the week, millions of people are taking them across the UK. Tons of cocaine being hoovered up. Tons of dope being smoked, you know, and millions of ecstasy tablets being popped at the weekend, you know, when we're doing more clubbing and festivals and all that stuff. But people have still been doing it during lockdown. You know, Mrs. Miggins doesn't get it, and she won't be persuaded. And her lunatic right-wing Tory MP that she voted for, right, has to say that drugs are dangerous and illegal and we're going to lock everybody up, which of course we can't and we won't and we never will do. And so who wins? Who's winning out of her MP, the Daily Mail and Mrs. Miggins having those attitudes? Who are the winners out of all of this? The drug dealers, ladies and gentlemen. Oh yes, they love her MP. They love her and they love the Daily Mail, because that just means, because they're the roadblock to progress and reform, that actually means that they control the industry rather than you, me, the government, Pharma, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, which is how it would be if I ruled the world.
Exactly, and that's what we need. We need a campaign to get Peter Blexley to rule the world. That's exactly what we need.
Please don't.
No, but it's true. The thing is, I struggle to understand why. I mean, I do. I understand you've told me why, you know, these politicians don't want to legalize it, you know, because that's how they get their votes. That's how they get, you know, a seat, et cetera, et cetera. Fear mongering, it works. But it's slowly becoming a more obvious sort of thing where we're going, no, that does make sense. Because if we control the drugs and we're producing the best quality drugs that we're selling, you know, you refer it to as a drugs store. We sell it there and it's the, you know, the best quality. One, no one's going to go in a back alley and get it. They're not going to get dangerous drugs. They're not going to get poor quality because you don't know what they've got in it. You're going to go somewhere. You're going to pay a decent amount, right? It's not going to be expensive, like whatever, because everyone's got access to it. You're going to get the good quality stuff. Yeah. Pure. If anyone's watching Breaking Bad, yeah, like 99% pure, like yep. That. And then it's going to be safe as well. Like, and by regulating it, you're going to get rid of all these other, you know, backstreet drug dealers. And I feel like it is, and you've said it before, that we're making huge strides and unstoppable momentum in this movement to legalize all drugs. I think in that sense, are you quite happy with the sort of younger generation, and are they getting more involved in this movement?
I'm a father of three sons, right? My eldest boy is 33 and my youngest two are 19 and 18. And I'm having the great pleasure of chatting to you, a 19-year-old now. Do you know what? I'd put you all in charge in the blink of an eye. I really would. I would let you run the show completely, okay? Because I've got a sneaky feeling you'd abolish the House of Lords, right? I think many of you would make a very strong case for abolishing the monarchy, right? Ooh, I can just hear the tension, right? But I would, because as far as I'm concerned, in 2021, an unelected family has a member that is head of state. Excuse me? That's utterly undemocratic, completely undemocratic. It's 2021. Now, I know millions adore the Queen, and I've got nothing against her. I've never met her. And yes, she's devoted her life to public service, but she's also had a life that I've paid for. Right. And so have we all. Right. When she passes away, I would give her the send off that I'm sure many millions of people would want to give her. right? And then just go, right, okay, let's just stop this nonsense now. They're undemocratic. And it's 2021. And it's not like any of her children have been shining beacons of how you should conduct your life, have they? For crying out loud. You know what I mean? Who's name me a role model. Name me somebody that a kid who's brought up on the 19th floor of a tower block, right, living in social deprivation, could look at that family and go, I'm going to be like him or her.
Exactly.
What a nonsense.
Yeah.
What an absolute nonsense. I think they're a divisive force, actually, rather than a unifying one.
I mean, look what's going on.
I would quite simply abolish the monarchy. And I don't want to listen to all that nonsense that people talk about how they bring millions into the economy, right? What a load of complete and utter tosh. They come to stand behind railings, right? Behind which there are soldiers and policemen with guns, right? And the tourists stand behind those railings to look at Buckingham Palace. They don't actually go in and have tea with the Queen. They don't meet any of them. They're all surrounded by armed protection squads and they're miles away from the common people like you and me. We don't get to meet them.
They're in a complete different world.
Yeah, so people would still come to see Buckingham Palace, right? They'd still come to see it whether we had a monarchy or not. We need there is not a kid in the country outside of that family that when they're born and they're growing up and you say to them, hello, daughter, hello, son, what would you like to be when you grow up? If your kid turns around to you and says, mummy, daddy, I'd like to be head of state. You have to say to them, I'm awfully sorry, you can't be.
It's the only thing you can't do.
But it's like the highest position.
Yeah.
You can't achieve it because some bunch of people have it by birthright. Birthright in 2021? We having a laugh?
You know what I think is worse is, fair enough, how much political influence do they have? Not that much. But the House of Lords, who have a lot of political influence, I think there's 60 or some ridiculous amount of House of Lord members that were given it through birthright. So the only reason they have a position of power is because their parents had a position of power. How does that even make sense? And I want to ask you this, Peter, right? When you give me these sort of views, I mean, the fact that you said that you put us in charge, you know, I guarantee you, you're probably one of the only, 50 plus people in the country that actually believe in the youth rather than going, oh, they're a bunch of snowflakes and they're this and they're that and they, whatever. Why do you think you have such young views? I think that's why you look so good for your age, because you got young views.
My youngest two boys are teenagers. So I'm very much in tune with them and their mates, right? Now, please don't get me wrong. I do not hang about with them all night, right? I'm talking about pre-COVID. But when their mates come round, I do join their company for a while, okay? I know when to leave. I know because I get that look off my sons. You know what I mean? All right, Dad, you've been here long enough. But we talk politics, faith, the monarchy, all that kind of stuff. We do not talk sex. Let me make that blatantly clear, right? Okay. That would be too creepy for words.
You said I didn't.
No, that would just be horrendously creepy, right? Okay. So we don't do that, right? But, and we talk about that. And, of course, we talk about sport and cinema and all those kind of things. So I like to think I listen to the youth and I'm so optimistic about our future. Because of what I hear from the young people who I'm lucky enough to have in my life. And I don't use any of those derogatory terms, one of which you mentioned earlier on. I utterly detest it. And you know what? There are 2 days of the year that are guaranteed to do my nutting, right? And those are the days when the GCSE and the A-level results are published. Because you know what happens? Some old twat who went to university in the 1970s or maybe the 80s, right, goes on the radio or the television and says, well, of course, the results have gone up because the exams are easier now than they were in my day.
Oh.
And I will shout at the radio, right? Guaranteed. It's like, who's giving that person airtime? Right? Sit them down and say, go on there, mate. You go and sit 3 A-levels now, or 4, or 1, right? You go and sit a bunch of GCSEs now. And then come back after they've been marked and tell me how easy they are. It drives me mad. There are so many old, crusty people just willing to, like, trash the youth of today at any single opportunity, and I won't have it. What I will say is, after your generation have kicked out all those hereditary lords, and thank you very much for doing that, because I know you will. I trust you entirely, right? When you've done all of that, and maybe even you've abolished the House of Lords, what I would ask is that you do have what I call, like, a House of Seniors.
Oh, yeah. Like, okay? An upper house, because
there needs to be some kind of oversight and checks and balances on everything that we do, doesn't there? You know, all my work gets overseen and checked by an editor or a producer and that kind of stuff.
But how they have it in America. They have the House of Representatives and then they have the Senate
and,
as well.
And the Senate, yeah. So, you know, because I think, you know, some of us that are more senior in years, that there is wisdom with age.
Senate.
Okay, there is. Now, that doesn't mean to say that everybody who ages is wise, right? Not at all. I'm not saying that. But if you get the right, you know, House of Seniors, as I call it, upper chamber, whatever you want to call it, you can get some... You can get some good ideas. Of course, you get bonkers, lunatic ones and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, so when you're all in charge, do have a listen to some of the people that have been round the block once or twice, because they might have some views that will be of use and of help to you.
100%. There's a lot more that I want to ask about current issues and sort of your opinions on that. But I know you've got to go in a bit. So I really want to get into... sort of, and hopefully we can do this again if you've enjoyed it and what have you, because I want to talk more about, well, the man behind you right now. Well, I think my first question would be that most people wouldn't have heard the names Liam Kelly and Lucy Hargreaves, which is unfortunate, but could you explain why those names have now created what you've described as your new life purpose?
Yeah, certainly. And I'd love to come back, by the way, Tarek. Thank you for that. Just say the word, and I would be thrilled and flattered to do this all over again. Okay, I'll give a bit of background, if I may, because we haven't really touched on my police career, but I've got plenty of stories that we can save perhaps for another time. Just rewind a bit. In 1999, having been in the cops for 21 years, I was medically retired because I had to live in witness protection and I had a humongous mental health collapse. And at the age of 40, I found myself on the scrap heap of life, really. No education to fall back on, as we know.
Yeah.
Foolish me. No trade, you know, and none of apprenticeship, nothing like that. I wasn't the chippy, a sparks, a plumber, or anything like that. Nothing to fall back on. Pretty much on the scrap heap of life, trying to get well and stay well. And I got a publishing deal to write my autobiography because I'd worked 10 years undercover in the cops. Bonkers, lunatic, crazy time.
Crazy stories, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. My autobiography is called The Gangbuster, by the way. And even though it was published 20 years ago, it's a piece of work that I'm proud of. Every word is true. I've left it unedited for 20 years. So you'll notice the sea change in some of my opinions then to what they are now. They've just become a bit more refined, I think. I wanted to leave it true. And it still sells a few copies every year and people still enjoy it. Anyway, that kind of launched me into the media because it got picked up by a TV production company. So I got hired as a story consultant on a BBC drama series called Murphy's Law back in the day with Jimmy Nesbitt playing an undercover cop. I was suddenly on the radio and the TV every week, like I still am now, talking about crime and policing, their impacts upon society and more. And as part of all that being a media type bloke rent a gob, I got picked up by a Channel 4 program called Hunted.
Yeah.
Way back when it was just an idea on a piece of paper, really. And I was in that show from the outset. It was on Channel 4, did very well, was very popular, won awards, all of that. Got nominated for a BAFTA, and we got beaten by Love Island, right? Aww. I'll tell you the story about my dreadful night at the BAFTAs one day, right? Oh, my word.
Oh, go on.
I'm still haunted by it now, but anyway. Yeah, and having done 6 series of Hunted, so that was 4 of the main show and 2 celebrity versions. In February 2019, the last series that I was a part of, series 4, was aired, and we caught all the fugitives, because, of course, it's a show where members of the public pretend to be fugitives, go on the run with a view to trying to win a share of $100,000 prize pot. We as investigators, and I was the chief, are always determined to try and catch them. Mm. And in series 4, we caught them all. Yes, that had been our stated ambition amongst ourselves right from the off. And to do that was wonderful. It was, of course, unmatched, never been done before. And I don't know if it will ever be done again. But trust me, I drank and danced that night like I hadn't done in a long time.
What did you drink? I've heard you like Pawn Star martinis.
I drank everything. And wonderfully, because I did have a pint of water every now and again, there was one of the team was coming up to me like every hour going, "Chief, drink that pint of water," right? Which was, I was very, very grateful to her, because I actually remembered getting home.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
That's an achievement.
And I was fresh as a daisy the following day, you know, so it was all good. Anyway, so I left the show. I announced publicly that I was leaving on the night the last episode went out. Mm. And so I was thinking, what was going to be my next major project? My publisher had said, yes, you could do another book if you get the right subject material. And so my previous 2 books, which are On the Run and To Catch a Killer, they were about unsolved murders. I went out and researched them, actually, like my boots on the ground, knocking on doors, reaching out to people and researching them and writing about them. Upsetting the police along the way because I was highlighting their greatest failures. Well, I'm an investigative writer. If I don't challenge the authority, you know, if I don't challenge the establishment, then what am I actually doing?
You got kicked out of many groups, sort of ex-Met officer groups and things like that because of what you were saying. But you were challenging what you'd experienced.
Well, that was because I told the truth about racism in the police in the 70s and 80s. And my experience of it was that it was appalling.
Yeah.
And young black men were getting fitted up and beaten up because of the colour of their skin, because cops didn't like them, because they failed the attitude test. Yes, dreadfully, there was such a thing. And I've been very vocal about that over the years. And, by crikey, I've had some hatred come my way from racist former police officers who hate the fact that I tell the truth. And I'm all prepared for another major pile-on next month. It's end of March today. It's going to be April very, very soon, because it will be the 40th anniversary of the Brixton riots. And I was there and I knew all what caused it, what the run up to it was and all of that. And I've contributed to a BBC documentary and a BBC podcast. And I think I'm filming again a day next week. And I will once again be telling the truth, the unpalatable truth. Because you know what? In my life, it's never been the truth that's got me into trouble. It's always been the lies. I think there's a hint there somewhere. And so, yeah, I will get a pile on of hatred from former cops like you will not believe. Yeah. And I've been kicked out of just about every, you know, social media group, association. There's an association called the Metropolitan Police Ex-Detectives Association, and they kicked me out for bringing the association into disrepute. So I'm on the phone to the chair and I said, can I just get this right? You are kicking me out because I told the truth. Right? Silence at the other end.
Once.
I said, so as far as your association is concerned, telling the truth is disreputable. Have I got that right? Silence at the other end. Well, there's a quote from one of the Marx brothers. They were American comics way back in the day, M-A-R-X, Groucho, Harpo and Chico, I think. Forgive me if I've got one wrong. And I think Groucho Marx made a great quote. He said, I'd never want to be a member of any club that would have me as a member. You know, and that kind of that summed that all up for me. So anyway, back to Leaving Hunted. It's early 2019. My previous two books were about unsolved murders. And I thought, you know what? I've written plays for Radio 4. I've written three of those, which I'm delighted with, obviously. I'd written three books at that point, thousands of interviews on various things, but I was best known for hunting pretend fugitives on a TV entertainment show. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not going to get highbrow or precious about that. It was a great experience, and I'm very grateful for that opportunity. So I thought, right, what am I going to do? Combine my skill set and my experience, right? A lifetime of investigating. The network of contacts that I've got, ex-police, some ex-police speak to me, you know, the proper, decent, good, upstanding good ones.
Yeah.
Ex-military, ex-police, open source intelligence, cyber expertise, those kind of skills, and what I'm best known for, hunting fugitives, albeit pretend ones. I said, right, wrap all that together and hunt a real fugitive. So on the 29th of April, 2019, I held a press conference in London and announced my hunt for 6'5" Liverpudlian called Kevin Parle, P-A-R-L-E, who is still on the run. He's now been on the run over 16 years, and he's wanted in connection with two separate and ghastly murders. And thank you so much for mentioning Liam and Lucy's names. That means the world to me. The first victim was a 16-year-old child, boy, kid, call him what you will. He was 16, called Liam Kelly. Liam was gunned down in the early hours of the morning in Grafton Street in an area of Liverpool called the Dingle in a dispute over 200 quid. Lucy Hargreaves was shot dead some 14 months later in August 2005. Lucy was the 22-year-old mother of three young children. And everybody that I've met who knew Lucy tells me that she was as beautiful on the inside as she was on the outside. Three men burst into her house, blasted her to death on her sofa, and then set her and her house on fire. The intended victim of that attack was her partner, Gary Campbell, who was upstairs in bed with their two-year-old. The other two kids were with their grandparents. Gary escaped the burning inferno by kicking a window in and jumping out of a first floor window with the two-year-old in his arms. I have met Gary in recent months because he's become aware of my hunt for Kevin Parle, saw me on a podcast, decided that I was the sort of bloke he could talk to, and he's reached out to me. And his interview, the interview that I conducted with him, we've recorded for our podcast because a few months into my hunt for Parle, the BBC commissioned a 12-part podcast series called Manhunt, Finding Kevin Parle. And that is still on BBC Sounds, wherever else you might get your podcasts from. It's been downloaded over 3 million times.
Yeah.
It's won an award. And it's a piece of work that we're very proud of. But, of course, what it has done is become a very important and useful tool in encouraging people to come forward and tell me what they know about Kevin Parle. And that is absolutely vital because, of course, the hunt goes on. He's not been found yet. Those handcuffs have not been slapped on. So this is my life's work now, hunting Kevin Parle. And I will simply never give up until either, of course, he's found or I die. whichever comes sooner. It's as simple as that. Not only was is the hunt for
Pearl. You'll find him. Yeah, you'll find him.
Yeah, yeah, he's hoping. Yeah, I'm sure. So not only is it the subject of the podcast, but it is also, you may remember, I said my publisher gave me a contract to write a book. It is also the subject of my latest book, which is called Manhunt. It is very, this book is very, very different from the podcast, okay? Because, of course, this is written in the first-person narrative. It's my journey. There's a lot more of the personal journey of mine in the book. It's all my personal journey. It's the highs, it's the lows, it's the crushing disappointment, it's the dreadful mistakes that I've made. And about the nicest thing people can say about it is it's so honest. And, you know, it's me, warts and all. So these are not profit-making things. These are about finding Kevin Pearl. So many, many people have downloaded the podcast and read the book. You can do both because they're such different things. And if you do, please spread the word about Kevin Pearl. Let's raise public awareness of Pearl and the crimes he is wanted for. That is how we are shrinking the world for him. That is how we will squeeze the globe so tightly that his 6'5" ginger nut pops up somewhere and law enforcement can slap the handcuffs on. Because this is about justice. And we all have to believe in a sense of justice, I think, because when things are not just, it leaves a very, very sour taste, to say the least. Look at the Hillsborough disaster and that 30-year fight for justice that the people of Liverpool have been engaged in. That city knows about things that's injustice and the like. And I've been there many, many times since I started my hunt for Pearl. It's a city I love. They're people I love. And I hope not to let them down. Yeah, it's a global story because Pearl, whilst he's been on the run, I know has definitely been in Spain, Dubai, Thailand, probably Ireland, possibly Australia. So it's a global story. Please read it and listen to it. Get across it, ready for when we can start traveling again. You may carry the thoughts of that 6'5" Liverpudlian in the back of your head, in your subconscious somewhere. And you may just walk down a street and think, oh, I'll give Peter a ring. I could not be more contactable. And I don't care how dated your information is about Pearl. If you went to primary school with him, I'd still like to hear from you. I could not be more contactable. I'm on Twitter, Insta, Facebook, and excuse me. Oh, that always happens to me when I mention LinkedIn. Yes, I'm also on LinkedIn, people. The most tedious, tiresome social media platform ever invented, because you obviously have to have 14 letters after your name and be extremely important to go on LinkedIn. I can't stand it. Anyway, yeah, I'm on there as well. I've also got a burner phone. I've got a burner phone, the best 10 quid I ever spent.
10 quid, wow.
Yeah, 07908-617-694. And you don't have to have information about Pearl to contact me. You can have a thought. You can have a theory. You can have a contact somewhere in the world that might help spread my flyers, whether it be paper versions, like of my poster and my flyer, or whether it's electronic versions, because I will happily email them out to anybody anywhere in the world, same as I will put a few in an envelope and post them to anyone anywhere in the world. And this is why last month I renamed this the People's Hunt for Kevin Pearl, because so many thousands of people, literally thousands of people, are helping me in this hunt that I wanted to rename it so that the recognition that the public so richly deserve for when he's captured is already kind of out there and cemented, you know, and I've taken it away from me. It's the People's Hunt for Kevin Pearl. So whether you retweet one of my postings or share one of my postings or want some flyers sent to you, I'll happily do that. Or you read the book, or you listen to the podcast, and you lend the book, or you give it away to someone, or you leave it on the bus for someone else to pick up. Don't let my publisher hear me saying this, right? You know, all of these things are great and will help shrink the world, and I will be forever grateful. And the one thing I didn't mention was my website, peterbleksley.com. Now, my surname is spelt peculiarly, B-L-E-K-S-L-E-Y. But please, yeah, read, listen, share, like, retweet. Send me your details via a DM, and I'll put poster and flyers in the post to you. And let's carry on till we find him.
Carry on the people's front. Now, normally the end, I normally have sort of end questions, but since it's open to having coming on again, and I've got so many questions here, like, I feel like we haven't touched on half of them, on Kevin Paul, but also on your policing, on how you were in witness protection, and so much others, so many more stories that I want to get into. I'm not going to have those final questions because I want to save them for when we do actually, when you come on again, hopefully, and ask you them. Instead, what I want to ask you is with the Kevin Paul sort of, you're trying to find Kevin Paul, obviously. Have you ever considered of doing sort of almost a dedicated social media movement? So dedicated social media pages that are just about finding Kevin Paul? Because I know it's on your Instagram, it's on your Twitter, etc. If you almost have a separate one, obviously, you know, post whatever you want about Kevin Paul on your Peter Bleksley personal account, but then also have a separate one that is every time new information is out, it's on there. Every time there's a new podcast, it's on there. Every time there's a new book, it's on there. Everything. And it's literally, you know, on Instagram, it's the people's hunt for Kevin Paul. Twitter, the people's hunt for Kevin Paul. Because I feel like one of the issues is we need to get people to know the names Liam Kelly, Lucy Hargreaves. Like, they need to be embedded in everyone's head. There needs to be social media campaigns for it. And just doing everything that we can to just spread the word as much as possible. And I think I think you only need one thing to show how much you, Peter, want to find this guy, is the fact that you're telling people, share the book, leave it on a bus, give it to someone, whatever. You don't care about the money. You care about finding, you know, you care about justice for Liam Kelly's family and Lucy Hargreaves' family. And the reason why I keep saying their full names rather than saying Liam and Lucy are saying the victims of Kevin Paul is we need to remember these names. They need to be embedded into our brains so much that when we see, every time we see a 6'5" guy, we don't go approach him because, one, it could be Kevin Paul, but also it could just be a normal 6'5" guy that just wants to live a nice life. But 6'5", clock on, that could be someone. Like, we just need that in. So I think you should definitely consider sort of a dedicated social media campaign on all platforms that is just for the people's hunt for Kevin Paul.
That's, you know, it has an awful lot of merit. But essentially, my social media accounts are dedicated to the hunt for Paul. If I set up a whole new group, okay, someone's got to manage those. Someone's got to update that. You know, I've got enough work as it is. For example, I get up one morning and I'm just putting another post out there about something that's relevant. You know, I've got to do that across those four platforms, and I've got to speak to my website guy to get it uploaded and get it out there. You know, and all these things hoover up a lot of time. Yeah. And then, of course, I've got to deal with the responses. And I pride myself on engaging with everybody who messages me on social media. Sometimes it might take a few days if I'm really, you know, particularly busy on a particular aspect of the hunt for 2 or 3 days. And of course, from time to time, to put food on my dining room table, I have to do some other paid work. I mean, that's just a fact of life. But I do get back to it, and it makes me chuckle when some people will say, am I actually speaking to Peter, or is this a member of his team? But what you see is what you get. I'm in my box bedroom office in our house.
Every message is from you, yeah.
And this is it, right? You know, a team, blimey. Never forget, I am lowercase Z lister, all right? Firmly. But no, I will get round to it, and I love it. And I'm so lucky to have such a wonderful following who suggests some great ideas about the hunt, many of which I've incorporated. You know, I don't have a monopoly on good ideas. You people do. You wonderful people do. So send me your ideas, like the one you've just mooted, you know. And maybe if at some point a TV production company comes along and says, right, we're going to make a documentary about the hunt for Kevin Parr, I'll say, well, is there enough money for me for a year to have a dedicated social media guy or girl? You know, and then, of course, your vision can become a reality and they can spread it further and widely and do more connections and all that kind of stuff. So it's written down, you know, because if it's not written down, it didn't happen, right? It's written down. I really take on board what you say. And I'd love to hear from your audience if they've got thoughts and theories and all of that. Once, of course, they've listened to the pod and read the book, please, because then they'll be well read. It can get a little bit frustrating if people haven't kind of digested all the stuff that's out there and then ask me a question which has already been answered by the pod. You know, I don't get ratty or anything like that, and I do answer it, or I steer them in the direction of the pod. As you imagine, you know, time is a premium. It's like, you know, extremely time consuming, but I'm not complaining. This was all my idea, and it's my life's mission. So I'm not complaining in the slightest.
100%. And I've definitely, before you get on, I'm going to finish the book. I'm going to order it straight after this, and I'm going to finish it. I'm going to ask you questions about the book and also ask you the questions I've got on my document right here. But it's been a real pleasure, Peter. Thank you very much for coming on. I know you don't get any, you know, really anything compared to sort of the other stuff that you've done out of this, but I've massively enjoyed the conversation and just the abundance of experience that you've got, not just in as a police officer, but just, you know, as a guy, and what you've learned and your journey throughout and hearing about Kevin Paul. It's been fascinating. So thank you very much.
Well, let me say thank you very much, because this has given me an opportunity to reach your audience, to raise the awareness of Kevin Parr, of the crimes he's wanted for, the murders of Liam and Lucy. Let me just say, he's not convicted of these crimes, but he's very much wanted for them. I need to make that clear. There's a European arrest warrant out for him. There's a 20 grand reward on offer for information leading to his capture. So for giving me this opportunity, Tarek, I'm very grateful. And I give you a solemn promise that we'll do this all over again. You just ping me some dates and we'll make it work.
100%. We'll do it.
And that is it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I don't think I conducted the interview as well as I'd hoped. I was just really excited, looking forward to it for a few weeks. But hopefully we can do a part two. Let me know if you'd be interested in hearing a part two and hearing some more undercover stories about, undercover stories that Peter has. I feel like this one was like a part one, just to sort of get to know him a bit more, understand what's going on with Kevin Paul and his hunt. I've got the book. I'm definitely going to read that. It's on my desk right now. I'm going to finish the podcast series and just get them all done with. Make sure you go follow Peter on all platforms. The links will be in the description. And let me know what you thought of this episode of the podcast by DMing Instagram at MMHY podcast, me, myself, hopefully you podcast. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Spotify and all other podcast platforms. It is much appreciated. Have a great week. Until next time.